Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Verse of Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. This week, we're presenting the second half of my conversation with Dalar Gurik, Kurdish feminist and anti-capitalist, about the Rojava Revolution. The Rojava Revolution, as we spoke about in the last episode, is the name of the Kurdish-initiated project to organize stateless communities in northern Syria into three autonomous cantons in the wake of the Syrian state withdrawal during the progress of the civil war in that country. Rojava is west in Kurdish and refers to the communities of Kurds living in that area as distinguished from Kurds living in and struggling inside the borders of Iraq, Iran, and Turkey. Folks aligned with the Democratic Union Party, or PYD, in Rojava have been among the people fighting against incursion by Islamic State militants. After hearing from Dalar, we'll be hearing a segment shared by the folks at Anarchistisches Radio Berlin, which they work together from audio recorded by Furia de Radio, an anarchist program on 97 Irratia FM in Bilbao, Euskadi. It can be heard every Friday night at 7 p.m. in the Basque Country, or on mixcloud.com/Furia de Radio. That's F-U-R-I-A-D-E-R-A-D-I-O. The folks at Furia de Radio conducted an interview with Nikki Dinesh, an Iranian anarchist living in exile in Australia, this September. More content from Anarchistisches Radio Berlin can be found at aradio.blogsport.de. in German, English, Spanish, French, and more. A quick notice for folks in the Asheville area. Leslie James Pickering will be speaking at Warren Wilson College in Black Mountain this Monday, the 3rd of November at 7 p.m. in the Cannon Lounge about his life and continued activism despite constant surveillance. Leslie, former head of the North American Earth Liberation Front Press Office, author, publisher, and co-founder of Buffalo, New York bookstore Burning Books, has endured heavy state repression for years. Leslie will discuss the current ongoing FBI investigation into his work and life, as well as his extensive legal campaign to resist the surveillance. This event is free. Can't make it out to Warren Wilson? Well, on Tuesday, Leslie will be speaking at Downtown Books and News on Lexington Avenue in Asheville at 6 p.m. This is another free event. On Wednesday, there will be a benefit vegetarian dinner with music offered at the Wine House at 86 Patton Avenue in downtown Asheville. All proceeds will go to the Kurdish Red Crescent, offering free emergency health aid to the people of Rojava, in particular in the besieged canton of Kobane. This event runs from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. And finally, on Wednesday night at the Auditorium on Haywood Road in West Asheville at 10 p.m., there will be the opening salvo of a hopefully ongoing queer dance party series and safer space entitled Cake. This night will feature a performance by Boots Durango from Charlotte, and it's suggested that queers and allies come dressed as their favorite confections. What you say, what you say, what you say, what?
Heard about the new law passed in Pennsylvania? Super fascist Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett recently signed a law that potentially eliminates prisoner public speech. This comes on the heels of Mumia Abu-Jamal giving a commencement address at a college he attended. On the one day of the year that the U.S. didn't start a new war, Mumia became a news story, and Maureen Faulkner heard about Mumia's commencement address on the radio. Faulkner is the widow of the Philadelphia cop who shot Mumia in the chest and then forgot how to duck. She claims that hearing about Mumia is just too painful, and she needs Pennsylvania to pass a law to shut up Mumia so she won't have to hear about him. Yeah, no kidding. And so far, no one in Pennsylvania is smart enough to realize it's cheaper to hire someone to teach Fruit Loop Faulkner to change the channel on her radio. Instead, they pass a law to silence Mumia, and even call it the Mumia Law. Well, unless that's too painful for Faulkner. She may have to get another law passed to prevent Pennsylvania lawmakers from calling this the Mumia Law, and make them refer to him as the M-word, not to be confused with the N-word, which the judge used several times in Mumia's trial. How the M-word law works, super victims like Fruit Loop Faulkner whine to a judge about a prisoner making sense in public, and the court orders the prisoner to stop. That's right, no sense allowed. And keep in mind, in the case of Mumia, Fruit Lou Faulkner, the super victim, isn't complaining about public speech about her dead husband. Mumia never mentioned that dimwit who didn't duck when he gave his commencement. So ultimately, if the Pittsburgh Zoo blasts Mumia's voice at the animals reciting, "I'm a little teapot," and Fruit Lou Faulkner finds out about it, she can get a judge to silence him, conceivably, for life. In an interview with Democracy Now! On 28 October, Mumia points out how this new law is totally unconstitutional. It's so bad, in fact, that a worthless bunch like the American Civil Liberties Union, who has been useless since the 1960s, is thinking about getting in the ring. Now, to be clear, this law doesn't affect me. I'm in Ohio. But Ohio's smack dab in the middle of the ignorance belt with Pennsylvania next door. We know dog-swapping, wife-kicking hierarchs like Kasich and Corbett share the same brain, and what happens in the backyard of the Masonic Lodge doesn't stay in the backyard of the Masonic Lodge. I'd bet money that Governor JWoww follows in Corbett's footsteps on this. I mean, look, Pennsylvania's going after Mumia. I've got nothing but respect for him, but objectively, Mumia's politics aren't so radical. He's no revolutionary nor insurrectionist. He's not calling for bullets and bombs, gasoline and books of matches. He advocates reform, legal challenges and elections. His politics aren't that far to the left of, say, Oprah. Me, on the other hand, my extensive collection of writings on the topic of political violence will never make her Book of the Month Club. Governor JWoww shut me down for 8 weeks earlier this year just to gaze at my penis. Think he won't sign a similar law to this Pennsylvania nonsense in order to shut me down for good? Silence. So, I'm worried. But this impacts your rights, too. When states duct tape the mouths of Mumia and others, states take away your right to hear the whole story. The public discourse is amputated. From there, the ruling elite can take a butcher knife to other views and other speakers, and we all end up under the knife. It starts with a Fruit Loop super victim widow of a dead pig going after Mumia. It ends with book burnings, the dictatorial rule of flat earthers, scraps of truth smuggled out of concentration camps for others to read over the air, until the cops raid the station with guns blazing. It's not just Mumia's freedom under assault by Fruit Loop Faulkner and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. It's yours and mine. So what are we going to do about it? Defer to reformist tactics employed by the ACLU and trust them to defend us? Or are we going to make ourselves clear in a direct way to fascists like Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett? I would like to remind you that gas prices have been dropping and that matches are free, much freer than we are. For ESON, this is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio's Supermax facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, number 243-205, OSP, 878, Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. This week, we'll hear Dalar continue to speak about the Rojava Revolution, the Kurdish women's movement, media representation of women in Rojava, and in the YPJ Star militias fighting against ISIL, if there's an overlap between anarchism and democratic confederalism, and more. So, in particular, you've spoken a lot about how Kurdish women are struggling against the IS in Kobani and elsewhere. Can you talk more about the significance of what women face in terms of the IS and how they've been resisting?
Yeah. I would like to start with how the media discourse around Kurdish women fighting ISIS is framed at the moment, because I think it's very, very problematic. Because on one hand, you see suddenly this coverage of Kurdish women fighters against the Islamic State, as if this was something new, even though it really isn't, because Kurdish women have been fighting for decades, and also they have been fighting against the Islamic State explicitly for 2 years, but without much notice, because at that time it simply wasn't interesting for people what was happening there. And now, I mean, the fight of these women against this horrible ideology, which uses sexualized violence as a systematic tool of war by raping, abducting, and selling women as sex slaves. This is very complex because, first of all, this is not just an existential fight for Kurdish women. This is also a fight for the integrity of their bodies. It's a fight on ideological terms as well, because in many ways the Kurdish women's movement is the complete opposite, or precisely the opposite of the Islamic State. And it's first of all remarkable that in a society like in Kurdistan, which is very feudal and patriarchal, male-dominated, that women take up arms. This is very significant in itself. The fact that in such a society in which women are always forced into the private sphere, they don't have decision-making power, that they are able to pick up arms and fight. And so that in itself is very remarkable, but the fact that they're fighting against the Islamic State, that is explicitly feminicidal, is very significant on several layers. Because, for example, when the Islamic State abducts women and rapes them and sells them, some of them actually manage to escape, many of them are not accepted by their families anymore, because the concept of honor that is prevalent in the region rejects women that have been raped because they're seen as dirty. So this is also the mentality that Kurdish women are fighting for, that this rape culture society rejects women as if it was their fault that they got raped. I mean, everyone knows that it was not their fault, but still they are seen as dirty, and the blame is on the victim, on the survivor. So that's why the fronts on which women struggle against the Islamic State is not just physically, in order not to be captured and killed and subject to all kinds of violence, but also on ideological terms, because the Islamic State wants to completely silence women, whereas the women in Rojava try to establish a system in which there will be equal representation, in which women's rights will not be compromised, in which violence against women, regardless of who is asserting it, is not tolerated. It's simply not tolerated. It's criminalized. So that's why it's very, very significant. And the ways in which the media now frames it is either playing into the hands of Western imperialism. It plays with ideals of like secular Western principles, that these women are empowered in the way in which we want to see women empowered, but we actually don't have that kind of empowerment anywhere in the world. So it's really weird. It's a lot of fantasies that are projected on these women, you know, with these very sensationalist headlines, exoticizing women, romanticizing them, mystifying them as these kick-ass Amazons and so on. So it's very problematic, because the same people, the same reporters or whoever is talking on behalf of these women, because many people don't actually, they either cite them out of context, or they just assume certain things without giving any context. Very problematic, because they don't actually ask for their political motivations. They don't ask about how come that there is such a movement. And it has a lot to do, I mean, the fact that women take up arms in Rojava right now, it has a lot to do with the fact that the PKK has half of the ranks of them are women, and the PKK's ideology on women's liberation and so on. And many people that are fighting in Rojava right now are actually former PKK fighters, or Guerrilla fighters. So if you romanticize women and try to degrade the Islamic State by saying, look, these women are fighting them, which is like such a shame to them, because one of the headlines that you always, always hear in every single article, it says the Islamic State is afraid of women because if they get killed by a woman, they cannot go to heaven. But this really, really simplifies that, because first of all, nobody actually knows if they really believe that. This is just something that somebody has said and everyone picked it up. And secondly, that's really not the core issue here. The women have political aims, they have motivations, they have their politics. And if you just romanticize them because you really hate the Islamic State, you don't actually really care about what these women want, this is something very problematic. And in terms of, you know, if we now look at the whole interventionist politics going on right now, it's, let's say, Western media specifically tries to instrumentalize women for the fight against the Islamic State, but they're also not willing to support, for example, the Rojava administration. They're not willing to decriminalize the organization or the ideologies that these women subscribe to. I mean, this is just a co-optation of a legitimate cause for different agendas, and that's why this is very problematic. So people who now want to understand the significance of Kurdish women, or not just Kurdish women, because many of them are also Syrian or Arab women that have taken up arms along with them. Still, most of them are Kurdish women, especially in Kobani. The majority of people, the vast majority of people, are Kurdish. It's important to look behind that. If you want to really understand it, you need to know that there's a legacy of a movement behind this, there's an ideology behind this. This did not just come out of nowhere. This is nothing that is inherently Kurdish. But, I mean, this has to do with an ideology, and this ideology is internationally labeled as terrorist, just like the Islamic State. So people need to ask questions about that rather than sensationalizing the fight of Kurdish women. So we can say that these are, at the moment, especially in Kobani, but generally, it's two opposing systems, the fight of Kurdish women, or just women in general, in the region against the Islamic State. Is not just physical, but it's also ideological, political, because the women fight for themselves as women against their own patriarchy. Before that, they have been fighting against other patriarchal state systems. They have been fighting against domestic violence in their own homes. So this is, in many ways, Islamic State is just an extension. It's a more extreme version of violence against women that happens everywhere. It's still, I mean, still the most vicious form, but their premises, domination, humiliation, dehumanization are very much the same, and you can find the same elements of that concept of power and domination everywhere in the world. So that's why people should not, of course Islamic State is horrible and none of that legitimizes it, of course not, but simplifying it in such a way is also very problematic because it racializes a region, degrades a religion that is part of many people's lives, and many of the people that are fighting Islamic State, especially in Kobani, there are Sunni Muslims. So these kinds of articulations of the discourse are very, very problematic, and they actually draw attention away from much larger issues.
Somebody brought up this quote that was, the new colonial paradigm is the white man going to save the brown woman from the brown man, the legitimization of the, you know, invasion of Afghanistan by the U.S. in terms of supporting Rawa and supporting feminism there, as this very, very just shallow, tongue-in-cheek justification by the administration.
There have been videos or articles written about some American men, former army veterans, who have now joined the Kurdish forces in Rojava to fight against the Islamic State. And they have been also just very similar to the women fighting. They have also been receiving all this coverage. And also all of these Dutch and German biker gangs who are now joining en masse the fight against the Islamic State. I mean, they can, for example, start by questioning their own governments and their invasion, their starts of unjust wars that have created such a situation. So it shouldn't be like the anger of people, the shock of the fact that the Islamic State, something like that exists now, should not just be directed towards the jihadists, but also towards this whole system that made this rise possible, that actually fueled it. So this white man coming in to save brown women from brown men, this is also very, very patriarchal implication. Because like I said earlier, war and conflict in general, and also especially in these ethnic terms, is always protecting women as if they are parts of the land. And men protect the women because the other, the enemy, is seen as a rapist. One of, you know, it's the same way the people fear that the enemy will come and steal their food and their homes, they feel that they will rape their women, because women, then they will not be theirs anymore. So women as property. So in many races, when we analyze racism, in many ways, I think the case has been made by black feminists, especially that in America, in the United States, a black man was seen as, you know, racist of white women, that they will come and rape white women and seduce them and so on. So these kinds of discourses around war and conflict and conquest are always in terms articulated around the body and the sexualities of women. So the brown man, the Middle Eastern man, the Muslim man, have been, especially in the post 9/11 era, stereotyped, or, you know, how do you say that? The discourse has been that these men are inherently patriarchal. They beat their wives, they do this, they do that, all of them, because this is what their religion tells them. This is what has also been used to legitimize foreign invasions, to legitimize bombings, military intervention. So people, you know, these kinds of things, you know, there's using women as a justification to do something that will also be very bad, you know, such as military intervention, with the premise of wanting to save women. But actually, you don't save women. You sometimes make the situation worse for them, because now you bring war to their country, and then women will be affected by it most. This is something, this kind of discourse is inherently patriarchal, because it always starts with the premise women have to be protected, and also it plays in with racist or very stereotypical characterizations of the other play into this as well, the Muslim man, the brown man, as this rapist, as this macho, disgusting person that will not treat women right. So now we, the white men, have to come in and do this and that. And this completely isolates everything from, for example, the vast prevalence of rape and sexual violence in the American army, and so on. So it's just very oversimplified, very complex issues in order to legitimize things such as foreign invasion. And this is very, very problematic. And in the case of Kurdish women, I think it's especially sad. It's also different, because in this sense, women are almost portrayed as actors, as people who take their destiny in their own hands, but actually not really, because still, the system rejects the route to acknowledge their aims. Even though U.S. media or U.S. politicians applaud people in Kobani resisting, especially the women, they will not support their political ends. So that's why we see it's still not very genuine.
In your view, why has the U.S. government actually pressed Turkey to stop blocking support for the PYD in the form of, or YPG, I guess, in form of arms and small arms and the airstrikes against the IS, after prior stating that Kobani is of no strategic value to them? Do you feel that there's any danger of entanglement with the U.S. imperial interest by engaging alongside of the U.S. state, since it has a tendency to attempt to manipulate opposition groups around the world with implicit and explicit manners?
Yeah, I this is a very good question, and it's a very important question, because I think the main reason, I mean, there's probably many reasons, and not all of them are exposed to the public, but I think, I mean, the U.S. government announced that they will degrade and destroy the Islamic State or something similar to that, but they failed. I mean, they didn't manage to do it. They simply couldn't do it. And I think everyone, Turkey, the Islamic State, and the coalition, all expected Kobani to fall within a few days. Nobody expected that the people could resist for more than a month. So, seeing that Kobani, what Kobani symbolizes, not only for the Kurds, but also for Turkey, for the Islamic Kobani, has a lot of symbolic importance. I think the U.S. government saw an opportunity then, but only after waiting for several weeks, to actually stop the Islamic State there in order to be able to say, look, our strategy somehow worked because we did something there and it worked. But actually, it wasn't the aid of the U.S. Army, but the resistance of the people. I mean, for several weeks, the people had were all by themselves, and they were protecting themselves and attacking the Islamic State with whatever they had left. So this opportunity was a golden moment for the U.S. to say, look, our strategy has worked, and also to look like the savior of Kobane, and also gave the opportunity to, as I said, to legitimize their strategy. So, I mean, but this, of course, put them at odds with Turkey, but also Turkey, due to internal dissent and also due to increasing international pressure in the media by the civil society, etc., because people saw very clearly that the armies of the Turkish, the tanks of the Turkish army just sit there by the border watching the Islamic State, waiting for the Kurds to be massacred, and Erdogan still smiled and sets conditions for his support for Kobane, exploiting the desperate situation of Kobane, and also killing the chance of peace with the PKK at that point, because this was a good opportunity to actually show that he's genuine. Due to that also, the fact that people realize, especially in America, that Turkey has first supported these jihadists, I mean, Biden said it himself now, not just Turkey, but also Qatar and Saudi Arabia, and now it is refusing to let the Americans use their air bases, and it's watching the Islamic State there. This also caused Turkey to take a few steps back then. So I think the whole situation, I mean, in spite of this threat of genocide, at the end was almost, I mean, I don't want to say good for the Kurds, because it wasn't, but it's the fact that these two powers that contributed to the situation were then in contradiction to each other, that was a good chance for the Kurds to get some reveal there. So it's also the question about imperialism. Yes, it's very, very important for Rojava not to be co-opted by anyone. Because, I mean, many people have criticized the call for arms by the YPG, the YPG, and the YPJ for military support because of, you know, questions of imperialism. But, I mean, people were faced with a genocide. The Islamic State was knocking on the door. People needed arms, and they did not care where it was from. So, actually, I think it was on some social media, somebody told me that somebody was telling the one commander of the YPG that why you shouldn't ask the U.S. for arms and stuff. And he said, well, had the international left, would they have arms, we would ask them first, but we can't. We have to ask whoever is able to provide us with arms of that. So now what's very, very disturbing is to see that the left has been very slow at picking up what is going on in Rojava, and often still stuck with these very old-fashioned classical questions about that. When, I mean, of course, military intervention, global arms trade, these are always, always questions that the leftists have to ask themselves. These are very important. But, I mean, as a Kurdish refugee myself, I mean, most of the people that I grew up with, their villages were destroyed because of arms, tanks from European countries, from the U.S., and so on. So we have always been against global arms trade, against military intervention. We, of course, realize that the unjust war in Iraq, for example, and then the politics in Syria by all kinds of countries, they contributed to the situation. So we have no illusions about that. We know what imperialism is. But exploiting the contradictions of the system, exploiting the fact that NATO member Turkey and the U.S. were in conflict at that point, and especially when you're faced with a genocide that will definitely take place, because we have seen what the Islamic State is capable of when we look at the situation of the Yazidis, for example, in August, the people simply don't have the luxury to debate these things. They needed weapons. But what's important now is for them to have their conditions as well, to insist on things, to not compromise, to insist on being acknowledged, to insist on that this revolution will not be hijacked by anyone. And also, it is very important for the world to understand it was not Turkey or the U.S. or Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the people that now joined the coalition that rescued Kobani. I mean, the people were resisting there for 30 days with Kalashnikovs. Grandmothers, grandfathers had armed themselves. Teenagers were fighting. That is what saved Kobani. Because from the first day, people were predicting the fall of Kobani. They were so sure. All of these governments, all of these parties, all of them said Kobani is about to fall, but it didn't, and it's certainly not because of the actions of the international community. Yes, they helped, of course. I mean, I'm not going to lie and say the airstrikes didn't help, but the airstrikes would not have come had the people not resisted. The people resisted, and Kobani didn't fall, and then the administration of the U.S. and the coalition, they saw, well, this is a good opportunity to legitimize our strategy, and maybe we can even do something in Rojava. So it's really, really complicated, and it's important that the Rojava revolution was also so successful because, in a way, in a very messed up way, there was no support. The people, due to embargoes, political and economic, due to marginalization, due to exclusions, they had to come up with creative ways of doing something. That's why people actually managed to establish all of these things. So it is very dangerous. That's why it's our job to make sure that nobody can hijack this revolution.
This is The Final Straw on Asheville FM. More of our conversation with Kurdish feminist and anti-capitalist Dilar Dirik after this brief break. Many anarchists in the English-speaking world have been interested in what's been going on in Rojava, critically and uncritically, in terms of our ideological positions and what hopes we see for the models of dynamics in the revolution there. What overlaps, briefly, what overlaps and differences exist between your understanding of anarchism and democratic confederalism?
Yes. Well, I mean, there's also not one anarchism. Like, so it's give a very short, due to time reason, and also simple answer. I think democratic confederalism has been developed within the context of Kurdistan and the Middle East, with the knowledge that the nation-state system was explicitly, later by colonial powers, imposed on this area. It has absolutely no roots in the region, and this region is extremely ethnically, religiously, culturally, linguistically diverse. So the democratic confederalism system is in many ways tailored around these kinds of differences, these kinds of reality, and also the infrastructure, the environment there. So the fact that it claims to be a coalition, a cooperation of people, of wanting to integrate different peoples in the government, has a lot to do with the realities of the Middle East. So it is also, both anarchism and democratic confederalism oppose the state and its oppressive mechanism. Democratic confederalism, I think, well, I mean, this is, I mean, if you look at the situation of the Kurds, who are oppressed by different countries, and they're all very, very authoritarian and oppressive and violent, and so they know, it's a bit realistic in the sense that they know that they cannot get rid of the state in a very simple way or in a very, in a directly abolitionist sense. It is, has to be gradual, because, I mean, you cannot overthrow the Iranian state, the Turkish state, just like that. So it is building something in between, building something in spite of, and building something that transcends these borders, because I feel like in some ways anarchism sometimes I mean, of course it has an international perspective, but the situation of the Kurds, for example, shows, I'm not sure what I want to say exactly. It makes sense in my head, but I can't really articulate it. That these borders, the fact that they were drawn later on, that, people feel, you know, loyalty or some kind of closeness, kinship, whatever you want to call it, with people on the other side of the border. They want to create something, they want to farm their land together, and so on. It's important to try to figure out a system that can work in spite of these borders. So in a sense, I think anarchism is more focused directly on the state as an oppressor, whereas democratic confederalism addresses other issues such as gender equality, just the same way as the opposition to the state, if that makes any sense. Because and it's, I think, specifically due to the situation of the people in the Middle East, which is different from perhaps European understandings of anarchism. I don't know. I can't make a very good comparison.
No, I mean, that I think in and of itself, saying that there's like a different context and there's a different... I mean, anarchism as a capital A thing is something that has developed within a certain context and based on certain ideological developments that, for me to assume, would be the same case for Kurds or for Assyrians or for Arabs would be extremely Eurocentric, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, that's why I wanted to bring in the case with Kurds having... also Kurds on the other side of the border, their families. So the modern nation states in Europe, I mean, the way they were created were also extremely violent, extremely oppressive, and so on. But it's not as arbitrarily drawn, these borders, as they are in the Middle East, because it was explicitly people from outside, from Britain, from France, who just came and drew lines and said, this is it now, like, these are your countries now. Whereas in the nation state development in Europe, for example, was still oppressive but a bit more organic than what happened in the Middle East. So that's why the context is different, the realities on the ground are different. People, trying to define the state in ethnic terms or in terms of, you know, having a shared culture, simply you cannot do that, because in Turkey, there is no shared culture, because one culture was completely denied, one culture was subject to genocide, and so on. So the loyalties that the people have are different, and therefore the criticism of the state has also somehow different reasons, even though ultimately it both comes down to the critique of the state of as this oppressor, as this executor of power and oppression and hegemony. But still, the ways in which it affects the people in the Middle East, who are also very much subject to ethnic and religious oppression and so on, which is less the case in Europe. I think that's why the priorities sometimes seem to be different.
When some of us think about how the Kurdish independence movement has shifted away from aspirational nationalism toward anti-state democratic confederalism, it makes me wonder if that same shift is possible within the Palestinian Liberation Movement as another large stateless society. The forces that give rise to each are very different in some important ways. But there is a similar core question. When does a group of people denied statehood actually come to critique the idea of statehood per se? We're interested in whether there is any kind of dialogue between Kurds and Palestinians, or in particular, Kurds in the Rojava Revolution and Palestinians about the meaning and expression of a struggle for self-determination outside of bids for statehood?
Yeah, this is also a very good question. The situation of the Kurds is in some ways very similar to Palestine, but in some ways it's not, because the Palestinians were occupied by the Israeli state, but people in Kurdistan, for example, it's four different states. So the context is different in many ways. So, because for the Palestinians, this is their land, and for the Kurds, it's also their land, but it's divided into four, and there are therefore so many differences that people in Turkey, for example, and people in Iran, they don't feel like they don't have the same sense of belonging because they have been so separated from each other, and they have experienced so many very different things, so that there is the collective feeling of collectivity is different there. It's very much separated and so on. So that's why critiquing the state has developed in Kurdistan, I think, because of the exposure to four different very oppressive states and seeing the ways, like what it can do to your society. I think there's, well, actually the PKK in the early 80s was actually trained by the PLO. During the capture of Abdullah Öcalan, Mossad, the Israeli secret service, played a big role. So there, the Palestinian conflict and the Kurdish conflict are actually linked in many ways. So at the moment, I'm not very sure. I know there's some statements from Palestinian groups, from the progressive left Palestinian groups that have, you know, especially with the situation in Kobane at the moment, they have expressed their solidarity, the need to work together. But I don't know if there's actually something developing with regards to the critique of the state. I don't know if there's a collective effort there. I know there are very similar things with, you know, alternative economies, alternative existence struggles and so on, that are very similar in the case of Palestine and the case of Kurdistan. But I think, yeah, to be honest, the fact that the Kurds have been exposed to four different states has made them more attentive, I think, that to the fact that the state is the problem, because of seeing what it can do to you and in so many different ways, and separated people so much from each other, that also, I think, in many ways, it was not possible anymore to think of an independent, united Kurdistan, because of the ways in which people were so alienated from each other. So the rejection of the state also comes from this smaller sense of universal pan-Kurdish awareness of identity, I think, which is more the case in Palestine. People feel as Palestinians, whereas the Kurds in Turkey may not feel as culturally similar to the Kurds in Iraq or in Iran. So that's why this independent Kurdistan dream was probably also due to that, due to this division and so forth. So I don't think there's one answer to it. And I know there's always solidarity between Kurdistan and Palestine. Sometimes there has not been very solidarity with each other. There's often a co-option of these two conflicts. Iraqi Kurdish government, for example, has actually close ties to Israel. The people there were very happy when, shortly before the attacks on Gaza again, no, in August, the Netanyahu said, "I support an independent Kurdistan," and then the people there were so happy about it, which is a shame, because how can you say that? How can you legitimize what the Israeli state was doing for the Palestinians? But you yourself know what needs to be wiped out for being who you are. And also the Israeli state, I mean, was founded on the, you know, the instrumentalizing the Holocaust for their purposes. So it's really, really interesting how these three groups of people can sometimes be co-opted and made to hate each other or attack each other, even though they should be the ones who know best what it means to be wiped out. So, yeah, I don't know, that was a bit off-topic, I think.
I think that Netanyahu can say that because the founding of an independent Kurdistan would take land away from people that he considers, or nation states he considers to be enemies, and build another, like...
Yeah, they have, also they have common enemies, like different Arab countries and so on. So that's why it seems for them this natural ally. And also, Iraqi Kurdistan, different from the PKK-related Kurdish parties, for example, has often, I mean, it's the darling of the international community, U.S. and of Turkey and so on, because they are the good Kurds, if you will, and they are like something similar to Israel in the eyes of these countries. to the U.S., for example, a secular group that is willing to cooperate with them. And in the case of Israel itself, is of course much more powerful than Iraqi Kurdistan. So Iraqi Kurdistan is much easier to be co-opted. So that's why their alliance seems to be natural to them. But for on a moral level, it should really, it's really embarrassing how in some of our ISIS, like anti-ISIS protests, for example, there were people who tried to distribute Zionist flyers because they thought, well, the Kurds are the only ones that are against the Islamic State. So they just used that for their own Islamophobic or anti-Arab agenda, same thing that racists are doing here. So it's very, very dangerous because the Kurds are not fighting the Islamic State because they're Islamophobic or against Arabs. They're fighting them because they're killing them. So it's very easy to co-opt this situation. So many, and it's sad to see the right wing being more mobilized than the left.
Thank you so much for answering those questions and chatting. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm so happy that we have this conversation.
You can find writings by Dalar at Dalar, that's D-I-L-A-R, 91, the number's 91, .blogspot.com. And now that promised segment, the interview with Nikki Danesh.
Sagen Sie jetzt mal bitte,
Anarchie.
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 Ob geschichtlich oder brandaktuell?
Mit Berichten und Interviews, mit Beiträgen und Collagen
beleuchtet das anarchistische Radio Berlin das Phänomen des Anarchismus.
Viva Anarchie!
In the following, we present an interview with Nikki Danesh, an Iranian anarchist living in exile in Australia, made by Furia de Radio from September. Furia de Radio is an anarchist program on 97 Iratia FM in Bilbao. It can be heard every Friday at 7 p.m. in the Basque Country or on mixcloud.com/Furia de Radio. As Anarchist Radio Berlin have edited the English version of the interview from the original program into a single segment to help with its distribution.
Hello, Nikki. How are you?
Thank you so much, and thanks for your time for doing this interview.
Thanks for being here at Furia del Radio. Well, you're an anarchist woman, an anarchist from Iran. And first, we would like to know more about the anarchist movement inside of Iran, and also about the Iranian people living outside of Iran. Can you tell us something about that, please?
Anarchist movement in Iran, in comparison to other movements, maybe it's a bit younger than the other kind of movement. But what I can say is that anarchism was existing actually before revolution as well. But after Islamic revolution, soon after they established the situation in Iran, then the uprising has started. And alongside with that, there were lots of anarchist students, school students, university students, and also among workers that they were demanding for their right. And of course, Islamic regime is a very brutal regime, and they do not let people so easily to fight for their rights.
So you said the anarchist people are especially among the students in the university, right?
Yeah.
And are the ideas also to be found in the workers' unions? I mean, do some of the workers have these ideas, libertarian ideas, anarchist or so?
There are also amongst workers, especially that the workers are suffering a lot from the brutality of the Islamic regime, because they also even do not receive their salary regularly, maybe always 6 months or a year later. And that's why, as a result of that, then people started to organize themselves like a self-grown
anarchist among different layer of the society, including high school students, university students, and also among the workers. Without being belonging to any specific organization, it is like a self-grown anarchist.
What is the answer of the government to these people who demonstrate? How does the government treat these people?
Actually, the biggest uprising after Islamic Revolution that we had, it was 5 years ago, before Egyptian uprising, before Egyptian Revolution. And Egyptian Revolution has happened 2 years after that, two years after that. So before that, Iranians came in millions to the street and to show their unhappiness. And amongst them, there have been lots of anarchists.
Yeah.
And soon after it was a mass movement in Iran at that time, and for that reason, because the Islamic regime was very, very shocked and they couldn't imagine so many people come to the street without fear, and that's why they started a huge oppression in a very brutal way. They have arrested people, they have tortured them, they have imprisoned all those wonderful young generation. And they even have raped our people, our young generation, with broken bottle. And the day after, they have given their body back to their mother and father. And as a result of that, it has created a wave of fear among the society for many months. But then people started to come to the street again and again.
Here in the Western countries, we lack information about countries like Iran or others. So can we say that there is a major movement against the government there, at this time, I mean?
The situation in Iran is like that every second people can explode. The situation is so uncertain that because of unhappiness. And the whole propaganda that you see from the TV that the people are supporting the Islamic regime, they are actually, the majority of them are innocent Afghan refugees that government will force them to show their support to the government, otherwise they will throw them out of the country. Because we have many millions Afghan refugees in Iran.
Yeah.
And that's why Iranian regime used these innocent people when there is the election, or when they want to show to the big TVs that we have lots of supporters. They normally use these kind of people to give the wrong the wrong understanding all around the world. But in reality, I can easily tell you that over 80% of Iranians are totally unhappy with this brutal regime.
Yes. We lack information about your country, so every word you are saying is very important for us.
I understand that, because this is something that many other Western countries, they can get the right information from Iran because of propaganda.
I understand the propaganda topic. I think there are two types of propaganda. Propaganda from the Iranian government, but also propaganda from the Western countries, which is different.
Exactly.
So
I like a lot of what this, this Iranian writer, a woman who said, I don't know exactly the words, but I think she said like, it's easier to communicate between you and me than between you and your government and me and my government.
Margins are tropy.
Yes.
Arjun Satrapi is a great director, filmmaker. She has been lots of her life in long time of her life in France, and she made also a nice film Persepolis about the Iranian Revolution. This is only one of Iranian women that is active in this area, but we have lots of Iranian women that they are active in filmmaking, in writing, poetry, art as artists, and you know, we have over 4 million and about 5 million Iranian living in exile. And this is the biggest. This is the biggest population that in the Iranian history that has.
Yes, that's a lot of people. 4 or 5 million people outside of Iran is a lot of people. Yes. Another question we have is about the situation of women, and especially of creative women, like this one, or writers, filmmakers, artists in Iran. How is their situation of women in general, and especially of this kind of women?
Yes, I should tell you that after the Islamic Revolution, the situation of women and girls was among the other part of the society that was the worst one, because Islamic regime more than anyone else has targeted girls and women because and as you know, we are the half of the population, and for that reason they wanted actually to oppress or to silence the half of the population by forcing them to stay at home and just obey the Islamic regime. But Iranian women never have done that, never followed the Islamic regime. They have been always active in the society, always active in and I should also tell you that we have actually more Iranian women as student than Iranian men. And the reason is that Islamic regime could never success in its repression against women. And that's why women are active in many branches, including writing, poetry, artists, all other subject topics.
So, Nikki, last question. How do you feel the Western anarchist and libertarian movement, Western libertarians, think about anarchists in Iran and other Islamic countries?
Yes. Thank you so much for this question. This is actually a very interesting question, because we anarchists from Middle Eastern countries and Arabic world, we are suffering a lot from being left alone from the Western anarchists, because when it comes to, for example, to Palestinian issue, you see that all anarchists, they support them, and which that we are also supportive to Palestinian. We love Palestinian, and we are always for free Palestine. But the thing is that in Middle East there are so many countries that they are also suffering, including Iran in the top of that, over 3 decades of Islamic regime and oppression and killing and torturing, arresting and murdering of activists and anarchists and all other radical leftists. And we hope that this will be your interview will be a beginning of the Western support, Western anarchist support towards us.
We will try. I hope so. I don't know if we got much audience, but at least we'll be a little step further, right?
Thank you so much. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for being here on Furia del Radio, Nikki, and we hope to have you back some other times, okay?
Thank you so much, and I wish for the unity and victory.
Okay, thank you. See you, Nikki. Bye-bye.
Thank you, bye-bye.
Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio.